This is Judaism Unbound, episode 67, 7 weeks in Silicon Valley. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And we're here at the conclusion of our Omer series in Silicon Valley. Just to remind listeners, that's that seven-week period between Passover and Shavuot. And we decided this year to explore it sort of both, I would say, metaphorically and practically. Two questions, the way that this is how I'm thinking about it, Lex. You know, one is that metaphorically, we have this story in the Bible about the time between when we left Egypt, i.e. when we left an old version of Judaism behind, and before we got to Sinai, i.e. the new version of Judaism. And that seven-week period is that kind of period of not knowing. We could think of the whole 40 years in the desert being that, but at least metaphorically, we're talking about it as the time between the leaving of Passover and the receiving of Shavuot. And, you know, I thought it was interesting to imagine, where is that place today, that place of wild exploration? And it seems that that's Silicon Valley in our world today, or at least that's one of the places. So it would be really interesting to talk to folks that are working in Silicon Valley and thinking the way Silicon Valley thinks, and to try to sort of see if any of those styles of thought can be applied to Judaism in interesting ways. And number two, what I'm calling the direct way is the idea that maybe technology itself is really critical in this new way in which Judaism might develop, and to get a deeper dive into the world of technology might actually sort of open us to some new thoughts or some enhanced thoughts about some of the technology-based stuff that we've talked about earlier on this podcast.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you either inadvertently or purposely stumbled into a great little rhyming mechanism, leaving to receiving, from Passover to Shavuot.
So before we jump into the episode, I wanted to just open with a few thoughts, some of which are reminders of things that we talk about every time we do one of these Lex and Dan discussion episodes, and some of them are a little supplementary to that. The main thing that I want to talk about is really how listeners can help us take this work to the next level. And there's really a lot of ways. The simplest way for you to do that would be to leave us a rating, a 5-star rating or a review or both on iTunes or whatever other podcatcher you use to listen to our podcast, because that helps other people find the podcast. And another straightforward but maybe a little less simple way that you could help us is to make a donation. And we have a page set up on our website, www.judaismunbound.com/donate, where it gives you all kinds of different options of ways to make a donation. We really, really do need the financial support in order to keep this going. And we really are grateful to those listeners who've already contributed. And we're super grateful in advance to those of you who might be willing to contribute. And another thing that I wanted to bring up in this section is something that actually came from a listener suggestion, which seemed very obvious when it was made, but of course was not obvious. And we're really grateful to that listener for making that suggestion, which was to ask listeners if there are ways that are non-financial that you might be able to contribute. So for example, if people have coding skills or web design skills or graphic design skills, or people who are really great project managers, or people who are really great at writing book reviews or writing essays or blog posts or whatever. If there are ways that you think that you might be able to contribute to the larger enterprise of Judaism Unbound, either because you have an idea about how you might contribute and what's missing and it's something unique that you can do, or you have skills that you know are really valuable in the world, technical skills, graphic design skills, and you look around our website and you can see that we're sorely in need of them, we would be enormously grateful if you would raise your hand and say, I can help. So we'll talk about it more later in the show, but we really are hoping that in this sort of second year of Judaism Unbound, we're really going to be moving from a experience with our listeners where we largely put out thoughts and ideas and interviews and people take them in, to one in which we have much more connection with folks out there and we're really building something together. So now let's jump into the meat of the episode. We've had 6 weeks of interviews. I want to thank again our friends at the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto for helping us set up those interviews. And we talked to a wide variety of people about aspects of Silicon Valley and how that thinking might contribute to Judaism. Some of that we discussed directly with the guests, and some of it we didn't necessarily discuss directly with the guests, and we want to talk about now. So, Lex, I'm wondering what some of the ideas that most got you thinking over the last 6 weeks have been.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to start out with some pushback that we got from Eric Weiner on some of these questions, because I mean, he was supportive. He was not somebody, you know, speaking out against the power that comes with democratization. But what he said was ultimately that the fact that we all have access to Google and to all this data and information online does not necessarily mean that we all have tons of knowledge and especially tons of wisdom. And I can't tell if what I'm about to talk about is directly linked or indirectly linked, but here goes anyway. In the past, you and I have spoken about this issue of people not necessarily feeling they have permission to experiment with Judaism in ways that could be meaningful. And I really think that that links a little bit to this question of knowledge and wisdom. And I'll try to get at what I mean with that. I think one of the biggest issues we have in contemporary Judaism has nothing to do with Jewish knowledge, having it or not. It's with having the ability to find Jewish knowledge when you are curious about it. And what I mean by that is so people have Google, people know that they can, that all this stuff is out there, but people actually don't know how to find whether it's particular Jewish teachings or even contemporary Jewish art or whether it's whatever they're looking for. We haven't taught any of the navigation. We've spent so much time emphasizing like, here's what X holiday is in Sunday school. Here's what this thinker said in a Jewish studies classroom. But we haven't taught people. That's not what we need to teach them, because they can find out in 4 minutes, like a basic level, here's the what of Tu B'Shvat, if people are curious. If they know the word Tu B'Shvat, they can Google it and look it up. But what they don't know necessarily how to do is, let's say I majored in environmental studies, I work for an environmental nonprofit. I'm thinking of this because I know lots of people that are in this mold. Don't know anything about Judaism, am Jewish, but like have never really connected. And so people don't know how to sort of engage with and find Jewish material on the environment. Now, if they looked, they would find Tu B'Shvat, this new year for the trees, and they would then probably be able to do something creative and wonderful with that, as educated people like you mentioned, and often very creative. But I feel like our education systems and our broader institutional systems have been so built on like inculcating factual knowledge and the particulars of practices that we haven't spent any time teaching people how to navigate. And so people are in this world where they're like, oh my gosh, Judaism. Like, I don't have Jewish knowledge. It's this big thing. It's like if I had a dictionary and there was no alphabetizing of it, and I just had to like randomly page around over and over until I found the word I was looking for. And so I think we need to really consider, how do we teach people where to find what they're looking for? And I don't just mean text. I don't just mean like the stuff written thousands of years ago, although I also mean that. But like, what would it look like from an accessibility point, which came up in different respects with some of our recent guests, to make Judaism easier to navigate?
But are you raising like a technological question or an education question? Because part of my question to what you just said is like, well, why not just Google it?
Well, because I don't think people know what to Google. I think a lot of people don't know what they don't know, is what I'm getting at. One of the smartest things that anybody ever told me is, and I forget which teacher of mine said this, but it was like a high school teacher. They said, if you're studying for a test and you know what you don't know, you're going to do fine on that test, because you have a study guide or you look back at the material and you master the stuff, or at least get competent at the stuff that you don't know. When you're screwed is when you're not sure what you don't know. And that's actually, I think many of us can think back to high school days and think of those tests where we didn't even really know what to study because it was so like complicated and strange to us. We didn't know which terms we needed to learn that were going to be most important for the test. So we might have tried, but we didn't do well on that test. I think we have a lot of people, and it's not just a knowledge thing, though it is largely a knowledge thing. We have a lot of people who don't know who don't know about whether it's the web resources that are really strong Jewishly. Like, a Google search isn't always going to lead to My Jewish Learning or Safaria if you don't know how to sort of get to those places. Those are, for those listening, those are two really, like, My Jewish Learning is sort of a low barrier access to lots of basic kinds of information about all sorts of Jewish holidays and rituals and ideas, etc. Safaria is an online database of Jewish texts. Most of the texts that Jews would be looking to find anywhere they would find on Safaria, and they're in the process of translating those into English. I think that once you know about those things, you can search My Jewish Learning Kashrut or kosher, find some things out about kosher. If you don't know, then you're in this mindset of, well, there's so much out there and there's these different things seem to conflict and I don't know. And so people get overwhelmed and then we don't know what to do. So I don't know what kind of problem that is necessarily, but I do think we need to think about how we navigate our Jewishness and Jewish resources.
I hear you, but I guess I kind of think about it on sort of a couple of levels that I think are somewhat different, because, you know, I think about like a period where Jewish stuff was first being written down. So prior to that, it was all in the minds of these experts, let's say the priests, or, you know, right? And there was really no way to acquire that knowledge other than to pump a priest for information. But then at the point at which it starts to be written down, then it's like, oh, we don't need to teach people how to search for Jewish information. We just need to teach people how to read, because now Jewish information is being converted into a new format that actually nobody, none of the priests know how to access it that way either. It's a completely new format. So really, what makes you in the best position to be a creative Jewish thinker is no longer what it was in the time of the priests, where you had access to all this information the way that it had been held before, but really that you've mastered the way to access information in the next age. So now I think we're in the beginning part of that transformation right now, which is why it's a little confusing, because we haven't yet fully created those websites, for example, that you're talking about, like Safaria. It's still in the process of being built up. And so maybe it's not as simple to say right now that somebody should just Google it. But I would predict that in the next decade or two, it will be more or less that simple. You know, that we won't need to teach people how to access Jewish information, because Jewish information will be just as accessible as any other kind of information. And just as I don't really feel that I need somebody to teach me how to access information about, like, medical stuff. I mean, granted, I might be a little bit better at finding what I need if I had training, but I feel pretty comfortable that if I have a medical question, I could just Google it and I'll get a pretty good answer. Then the other question, though, is, like, once you can find the information, to me, like, I come back to this thing, like, I think it's a chutzpah issue. I worry that the point that the really important point, actually, I think there's really two important points. One is that Judaism is in transition. So all of the stuff that somebody who is fully immersed in the currently operative form of Judaism is going to say is the important stuff, that may or may not be the important stuff in the future. So it may or may not be a useful life skill to be able to master that stuff. But if it is necessary, a lot of people aren't going to do it because, like you say, it's overwhelming. I actually think that if we look at Judaism in 100 years from now, a lot of that stuff is not going to play a dominant role. It's still going to be there, but it's going to be sort of, you know, for people who really, really want to go deep into stuff and learn a lot of obscure knowledge. But so I'm more thinking that a Judaism that could really work for people is going to be a simpler Judaism. And I think that, like, the way in which that Judaism might come about is only if people out there feel confident in themselves that they can bring it about. And it's not in the interest of the Jewish institutions that exist to put that idea out there. So nobody's going to create Jewish education programs that are going to really, like, train people to find all this information for themselves. It doesn't serve the, and I don't mean this in a nefarious way, but it doesn't serve the interests of the current Jewish leadership class to say to everybody that, you know, you don't need us. So I think that's not to say that that on a deep level they don't want people to be educated. They do, and they're going to work to try to educate people, but it's not a driving need for them to accomplish that. So it feels to me like that those of us who have a driving need, a driving desire for people to be part of this creative process, I feel like the message that I really want to get out there is like, you can do it today. You know, you don't need to acquire all this knowledge of how to find things. Like, you could Google it and it would be 80% good enough.
I don't disagree with that. I continue to think that what I said before in terms of, I think what I said before would be of assistance to people doing what you just said now. I think if we, and I think you just sort of conceded that over the next few decades, we will create all of the systems that will make Googling actually lead to the kinds of results we want. I just want to make sure we do that as quickly as possible. Because I continue to see people that even though they do have those Google skills, there is a mental block. And what I think you're identifying, there's a mental block in the Jewish area of Googling, because what we've instilled, and this is a separate issue now, like what we've instilled in people is this conception that there is a very narrow and specific set of correct ways to do Jewish things. And that boy, and we haven't ever said that.
I think a lot of people have said that.
Well, yes, a lot of people have said that. But like, I grew up in a context where I was told, like, there's lots of broad different ways to be Jewish. You can celebrate some holidays. You can not celebrate. You can connect with what's meaningful to you, choice through knowledge, et cetera, et cetera. Like, that's a lot of the rhetoric that many people hear. And it's different from the rhetoric other people hear. But when it comes down to the actuality of it, when you change the melody to a random prayer on Friday night, 17 people on the ritual committee are shouting at you. And the congregation has been trained to feel that way, because there is, every local community has like the way, even though they know that it's not enshrined in history for everyone. But and then there's also the things that they do think are enshrined in history for everyone. There's a lot of people who know, for example, that on Hanukkah, there's this interesting debate about whether you start with lighting one candle and going up to eight, or you start with eight and go down to one. And in the Talmud, there's this debate about that. If you went up in your congregation's candle lighting on the first night of Hanukkah, lit eight candles and said a blessing, I think a lot of people in that room would be very upset because how, like, that's not the right way. And that's a micro example, but I think we have created an obsessive list of particulars to the point that people think that for absolutely everything Jewish, there must be a correct prescribed form, when often, by the way, there isn't. Like, there often isn't really an exact way, even in traditional materials, for how you should do things. But by the way, even if there is, like, screw it. The vast majority of success stories I would describe are breaking the rules. I mean, we've talked about this in the realm of the internet, because we have straightforwardly made a bunch of digital holiday initiatives that people are supposed to use on days where electronics are forbidden to a lot of people. Like, that's one example. Like, I think that now is the time to break that rule and to break most rules.
The thing, though, that I was trying to reinforce was that I don't think that people need to learn anything that they don't already know, right? I do think that as web-based resources like Safaria get richer and richer and better, you'll be able to Google even more stuff than you can now. But what I'm sort of trying to say is that what you can Google today is sufficient, and it's so sufficient that it is more knowledge than was available to the vast majority of rabbis throughout the entire history of Judaism. And again, I think that the limiting factor becomes self-confidence. And the other limiting factor, which I think is real, is wisdom, right? Wisdom is not something that you can acquire through the internet. And so the question becomes, you know, well, how do we make sure that the people that are creating new things Jewishly are wise people? And I would say that you don't make sure, that a lot of not unwise people create a lot of crap and nobody follows it. you know, what's to be afraid of? You know, so there'll be a lot of Jewish crap out there. I'm not afraid that people are going to involve themselves in crappy Jewish stuff. You know, like, it's, people understand crappy stuff is crappy stuff, and they're not going to do it. So, but I'm less concerned about like the false positive than I am about sort of the false negative, right? I'm much more concerned about the amazing Jewish stuff that could be created by amazingly creative Jewish people and non-Jewish people that are out there. That's not going to be creative because people don't think that they're allowed to do it. And that's where I would say, like, to me, that's where I think the revolution of the digital age hopefully helps more people have more chutzpah, because at least it tells you that if you're willing to think this way, that you can at least, should you at least don't have to claim an informational lack. Let's move on to some other pieces of our conversation, because I'll say that, like, one of the most exciting things for me, or one of the things that our conversations really got me back thinking about, was the question that we raised, you know, quite a while ago now, of whether the next iteration of Judaism is best understood as an operating system or an app. And, you know, just to remind listeners that back then when we talked about an app, you know, we also talked, like, an app doesn't mean that it's like a small thing. Like, Facebook is an app. There are apps that are very large that occupy a lot of your time online, or a lot of your time interfacing with your computer or whatever. But the difference between an operating system and an app is that an operating system is kind of undergirds literally everything that's going on, whereas an app is a part that you only access at certain points when you particularly are interested in that functionality. And when you're doing something else, that app might not be involved. And what was fascinating to me in our conversations were really two aspects of our conversations, one with Jesse Doregusker and one with Oren Ze'ev. With Jesse, what for me was really eye-opening was the idea that he sort of suggested that Square as a company, as a concept, and as a technology, the idea of taking credit cards, the regular people could take a credit card payment, was only made possible when the iPhone came into full force and people realized that everybody's carrying a supercomputer around in their pocket. So you don't have to invent the whole system anymore. You only have to invent the peripheral device and the peripheral and the app and the concept that hooks onto that and that takes advantage of all of that stuff in order to make this other thing possible. And Oren Ze'ev talked about Audible.com, that it was, even though it's a great idea to have audiobooks, right, it was failing as a company until the iPod was released and all of a sudden people had a digital player in their pockets, like so many people had a digital player in their pockets. And then all of a sudden Audible, which existed before, actually had something to plug into that actually made it usable. And so that got me thinking about Judaism in that way, that it really seems exciting, actually, to think about, yeah, Judaism had to be an operating system throughout its history because of the way in which Jews lived. They were cut off from the larger society, and so they needed an operating system. And realistically, this is what they had available to them. And there are all sorts of other reasons why it might have been normal and perhaps a positive thing for Judaism to be an operating system. But just because Judaism was an operating system doesn't mean that it has to be an operating system in a new environment. And if here in the United States, where Jews are fully accepted and feel so much part, so much, I would say, more part of America as a larger community that they feel part of than Judaism, that maybe it actually makes sense not to fight that, but to accept it and to say, okay, so what would it look like if Judaism was the most amazing app that runs on the American operating system?
I've been thinking a lot about the app question too, and I've like tried to hone in on some specific, like, maybe this will sound comically literal in the way I'm applying this metaphor of app and operating system of Judaism, but so I've been thinking about different kinds of apps. So I'm actually looking at my phone right now. When you get your phone, there are a bunch of apps that are already there. At least when I got my iPhone, there's like the weather app, there's like the calendar app, there's like apps that you don't even have to download. And what I think I would suggest is that Judaism, for people, descriptively, today, I'm not sure this will always be true, by the way. In 100 years, this might not be true. But I would say descriptively, in 2017, Judaism is not something that most Jews need to download. We still live in a society where having one or multiple Jewish parents sort of makes Judaism on your quote-unquote phone to carry. Like, it makes it one of those ones that you don't, it's already there when you get the phone. Mm-hmm. In 100 years, that so we might be living in such a post-ethnic world where actually the religion or ethnic identity of your parents doesn't preordain that. But for now, I think that that's the case. And I think that's something I was struggling with, because like, if Judaism's an app, like, you sort of have to download. I think, by the way, it also, like, there are different phones that, to dissolve the metaphor maybe, but like, there are people who are not born with that app, who are not Jewish, who absolutely can download it, and do, who convert, or who maybe don't convert, but they utilize elements of Judaism, the elements of the Judaism app in their day-to-day life. So I think that's important. And I really do believe more and more that, once again, I'm thinking a lot about descriptively and prescriptively. I think prescriptively, I'm actually not sure I want Judaism to be an operating system. At first, and even Zach Bodner sort of reflected this feeling, which I think was most of our inclination when we came to this idea of app and not app and operating system. He said, like, it's kind of sad to him that Judaism would no longer be an operating system when it has operated as such for a long time and really been a driving force in people's lives, in the sense that it is undergirding all of their, all or many of their decisions. That was my reaction at first too. I want Judaism to be sort of as big a player in people's lives as possible. And I want to make a Judaism that is actually good for the world, where having it a big part of people's lives has positive effects. The more I thought about it, though, the more I realized I may actually not desire prescriptively for Judaism to be the foundation for how people operate in the world. I'm not. It is inherently, and this is a positive of it, it's inherently a tradition that is historic and looks to the past for much of its teaching and wisdom. Now, we need that. I prescribe to it, and I spend a lot of my life engaging with material from the past, but it's difficult for me to think that the best place for me to undergird my moral values is through a system that dates itself to thousands of years ago. Plenty of people can disagree with me, but I'm less convinced that Judaism is significant or special or good because it undergirds people's values. Dan, I don't know, Dan, if you are with me on this, on the prescriptive descriptive question, so I'm curious to hear where you're coming from, but I thought I'd bring in that question of like the pre-downloaded app and the not, because I think it's important.
I also think that like a year and a half ago, I would have said that I would be sad if Judaism wasn't going to be an operating system. I think I don't feel that way anymore almost at all. Now, we have to talk about what does it actually mean for it not to be an operating system, et cetera, but I actually think it doesn't make me sad. Now, just because it doesn't make me sad doesn't mean that the ultimate answer isn't for Judaism to become an operating system, but it doesn't make me sad anymore. I actually really embrace and am excited about the idea of Judaism being an app. And number two, descriptively, I would say Judaism already is an app in people's lives. Right, Judaism is not functioning as an operating system in most of the lives of the Jews that we're talking about, the ones that are not currently being attracted to Jewish institutional life. And actually, many who are attracted to Jewish institutional life are not experiencing Judaism as an operating system in their lives. I think some of the finger wagging that tends to come from rabbis and other kinds of leaders is saying to people that you should make Judaism the center of your life. You should make it an operating system in their life. And I think people are generally ignoring them and have been ignoring them for decades, if not centuries. And so realistically, if we kind of look at the situation, we see Judaism being experienced by people as an app in their lives. The difference, I would say, is probably for many people, it's not a very important app. And so in my mind, the question is like, what would it look like if it moved from being an unimportant app to an important app? Now, the place where I think maybe you and I disagree is that I actually think that as a source of values, being part of it is actually a valuable app. Think about my life. The app that I really could use is the app that's about how do I define the values that I want to use as the values through which I live my life? And number two, how do I actually implement those values in the world successfully so that I actually live that way? You know, because I think there's and that's where I think actually some of the special skill of Judaism over the years has been is that Judaism, I think more so than most other religions, has profoundly been focused on practice. and on ritualizing practice, on turning values into habitual practice. I actually think that's a great strength of Judaism. I don't like a lot of the values that have been habitualized, so I think we should get rid of those values, you know? And I don't like some of the ways in which the values have been habitualized, because I think that they've, as tends to happen, without kind of a constant process of revision, the habits have been emphasized more than the values, and sometimes the habits and the values diverge, and we haven't always called it back to make sure that those habits are putting forth those values. So I think that we need to have a more dynamic process. But I actually love the idea that this app comes into play in my life at those moments where I have sort of value-laden choices to make.
Basically, where I'm at is a place of contentment that I didn't expect around the idea that Judaism is descriptively an app. When I look out at the vast majority of Jews, that Judaism is operating as an app. And what I want to think about more is if even for Orthodox Jews, like, it's actually not clear to me that Judaism is an operating system for them either. It's not that I'm sure of the opposite. I'm not sure either way. Basically, I do think that if Judaism is an app, which I think it is, and if it's going to be one in the future, we should be looking to identify ways that it will be a very important app for people. And what I actually am curious about is whether the Orthodox app or the Orthodox Judaism app might be an example of that, or if alternatively, Orthodox Judaism or other examples we've talked about in the past, like Israeli Zionism as an operating system, like people who live in Israel and have a fully different, like, I want to think more about whether those really are operating systems or if they too are apps. And the paradigm shift is that even the most engaged, connected Jews are engaging with Judaism in a different way from how many people did in a time where Judaism dictated everything from discrimination in society to the people you could spend time with to X, Y, and Z.
I think that you're right to raise the question of Orthodox Judaism and to ask whether it's actually operating as an operating system for people. I think that maybe for ultra-Orthodox Jews it is, because they've fundamentally gone what B'nai Lapi calls option one, and they've put a wall around their lives and really are operating, using Judaism as an operating system. I also think that, you know, probably Zionism is operating as an operating system in the lives of Israelis who live in Israel. That's right. These are ways in which they have chosen lifestyles in which they've placed Judaism, in one case a religious form, in one case a nationalistic form, as the sort of basic platform upon which their lives are built. But I think that you're right that there are many Orthodox Jews and many, many non-Orthodox Jews that really are living their lives on a different operating system. I guess it probably is the American operating system in America, and in other countries it's the operating system of whatever society they're living in, and that they're just doing Judaism at certain times, right? And that when they encounter, and it's just a question of sometimes they're doing it at more times than other times, right? You know, that's how often they're operating that app. I mean, it's like, you know, there's people who check Facebook obsessively, and there's people who check Facebook a couple times a day. For me, the insight of Square, as I understood it from Jesse Dorogusker, was that once we recognize that we're an app, or once we recognize that an app is needed in this operating system, or possible in this operating system, it opens up all kinds of possibilities that may not have been open to us as to what that app could do and what that app could be like. What does Judaism do as an app that it actually couldn't do as an operating system? And, you know, just going back to the politics, right, when we were talking about Judaism in the Trump era a while ago, you know, I'm thinking, right, if Judaism is your operating system, I think I talked about this, you know, when I was a kid, people used to say, are you a Jewish American or an American Jew?
Yeah, they did it for me too.
Right, there was some idea that, like, if you were an American Jew, that would mean that American was kind of your, like, secondary characteristic, you know, and somehow that would have an impact on politics.
It's counterintuitive, because you think the one that you say first is the one that's more important, but American Jew implies that Jew is the noun and American is an adjective describing that.
Right,
like,
exactly.
It took me a long time when I was in seventh grade standing in the room with my friends to get this, but that's why it's not intuitive at all.
Right. right? If Judaism is a way in which we are American, then potentially it affects our political choices in a different kind of way, right? Because it says that we can be better Americans because we also have this other source of values that helps us when the American values are indeterminate. Maybe it does come back to this point, what's the point of Judaism question, right? That whether it's an operating system or not, right? Like, what is Judaism there to do? If we can define what is it that Judaism is supposed to do, then the question becomes, hey, is it an opportunity that we now have a different iPhone to plug it into? Like, we don't have to be in the operating system business anymore. And actually being in the operating system business was getting us to not be have Judaism do what it's supposed to do because it was getting too bogged down in like operating system stuff. And if we're able to just focus it as an app, it's actually going to be much more able to do what it's supposed to do. That's the part that feels tantalizingly exciting to me. You know, that only framing the question that way potentially opens up an avenue of exploration that was not available to us, or that is not available to us, when we frame it only in this question of like, can an all-encompassing Judaism that functions as an operating system in people's lives, like, what's that for? Because by definition, almost, if it's an operating system in people's lives, it has to do all kinds of things, right? Because it's an operating system. Whereas if it's an app in people's lives, then we really can hone in on this question of like, what is it really there to do? And that feels very exciting to me. And I'm curious if listeners will have ideas, because I really think this is something that we ought to explore going forward. And, you know, just to make the connection to the Omer and to where we are in this series, I feel like this is the kind of question, right? That period of not knowing is a period of raising questions, not resolving them. And so it feels to me like if this wandering in the wilderness of the last 7 weeks, you know, in Silicon Valley has raised only this one question, right, that says, hey, we really want to double down on our exploration of this question of like, what would be served by the idea of Judaism as an app. That's actually a really exciting outcome of this time of wandering for us. I think there are other questions that have also been raised, but I mean, I don't feel the need to resolve it in this conversation, but I do want to really put a finger on it and to say, wait a second, this may be the most important question that's out there. This may be the way of asking the question that actually opens up many more exciting possibilities and answers and avenues for research than when we phrased the question, as I think we largely did at the beginning of the podcast, like, what would it look like to have Judaism 4.0, you know, to have the next operating system version?
I think that's a really good point, and I'm glad you brought us back to this Omer theme and sort of closing out our 7 week journey from leaving to receiving, as you put it at the top of the episode. I just wanted to bring into the equation, as we arc towards the conclusion, this anniversary of Shavuot Unbound, which was our first foray into the idea of like digital holiday observances. So a year ago, we came to this idea of, you know, what would it look like if we took this ritual on Shavuot of people staying up all night and studying Jewish texts, and we found a 21st century spin for it and housed it digitally. And it ended up being really successful. And we put it on our website, and hundreds of people utilized our different tracks. We had 1-hour tracks, 3-hour tracks, 6-hour tracks, 12-hour tracks for people who wanted to experiment in all different ways. And we got a lot of great feedback, and it led to sort of a big shift, or at least extension of what our organization was doing. And we started doing all sorts of different holiday experiences online. And I think as we sort of return back 1 year afterwards to Shavuot, it's important to recognize some of the implications of what this means, because the idea that people could share in an experience, but be in whatever location they are, and share in an experience is a real shift for how any form of Jewish experience has happened. And I'm excited for it to come together again for Shavuot Unbound this time, which is already live, but which will be added to and enhanced for our second go-round. And so if you're somebody out there who who has ideas about what it means for real experimentation and that spirit of try and see what works to make its way into Jewish identity and experience, this might be a great opportunity to spend some time with folks and to some extent, you know, use our materials, but also just think about what the heck would I want an all-night Jewish experience to look like, however defined, you know, and let us know, because we really do want to make this a connected experience where it's not just us putting out ideas for others to listen to, but really a partnership where the listeners are also creating themselves, yourselves.
And we should mention that one of the things that's being added to Shavuot Unbound this year is some short podcast episodes where we talk about certain aspects of the holiday of Shavuot. So those of you who are interested in continuing to pursue this question of what are these times on the Jewish calendar, the Omer, Shavuot, you know, I think that would be an interesting continuation to that exploration. And for me, like, the really exciting question is, you know, well, what is this all in our time? And we're discussing that on those podcasts. But fundamentally, you know, if the big practice of Shavuot became over time this all-night study session, you know, well, what is the opportunity of that in the period going forward? And we're excited about the idea that we could create some kind of digital all-night study session that you can both use practically digitally that night of Shavuot and actually study a lot and just read a lot and experience, watch a lot of Jewish ideas and kind of get a lot of ideas hopping around in your brain. But bottom line, the question is, like, what happens after that? You know, what's done with all of that? And what we're really hoping for this next year of Judaism Unbound is that we find all kinds of ways of doing that together with you in new ways. So one of the ideas that we're really exploring hard that a lot of people, or a number of people, have already told us that they're doing is creating these podcast circles, you know, basically book clubs with our podcast. And we're really looking to help more people form those kind of groups this year and to figure out how we can best support them and help them have the kind of conversations that they're looking to have, help them do all kinds of new things with the information and try things out and then report back to us what's going on, find ways to network people with one another. So, you know, we're really looking to figure out over the next year how we can really increase the impact of what we're doing. And we'd love to hear from you as to what you think will be most helpful to you out there, whether that has to do with creating podcast circles like that, or maybe you just are looking for more podcasts. Maybe you're looking for podcasts on different subjects. Maybe you're not looking for podcasts. You're looking for things to read. Are you looking for us to write things? Are you looking for recommendations? We're really trying to figure out how we really take what we're doing to the next level in the year ahead.
Yeah, that's totally right. I'm stoked about these podcast circles that we are pulling together. And I just want to emphasize that that's largely coming together because listeners reached out to us. I mean, we got a note a long time back. This was our first one, and we've had a few similar ones since, from folks in Ohio saying, hey, just so you know, we like your podcast and we're gathering, you know, a dozen folks to talk about it. And we said, that's great. And then, you know, we sat with that and got a few more messages from people with similar communities that they were building. And we're like, oh, this might actually be onto something. And so I just want to emphasize that we listen. We are so excited to hear from folks who have these ideas, especially because, you know, for us, just recording this into the ether, we know people are listening, but we don't know what they're doing with it. So having that understanding of the ways in which this can manifest that you're experimenting with really goes a long ways. So on that note, we want to close out the episode in the same way that we always do, which is a call for you to be in touch with us. In addition to all those important ways that you can support us at the beginning that we mentioned, you know, donations and reviews, we also just love to be in touch. So please, you can do so first at our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com, where once again, there's Shavuot Unbound being highlighted for the next few days into the holiday of Shavuot. And last but not least, you can always hit us up at our email addresses, dan@nextjewishfuture.org and lex@nextjewishfuture.org. And once again, if you want to support us with a donation, either monthly or one time, you can do that at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been 7 weeks of the Omer and Judaism Unbound.